This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It's an examination of healthcare. Crystal balls all over the nation are remarkably cloudy on healthcare. Colleen Canaday is the CEO of Advocate Bromen in Normal.
Unreimbursed care continues to go up for many reasons. You've got 10,000 people a day that are moving onto the rolls of Medicare that maybe yesterday were reimbursed by Blue Cross or Health Alliance through their employer, or people have high deductible health plans.
Also hear from Canaday about the effects of a merger between the Advocate and Aurora health systems in Illinois and Wisconsin. Plus, it's time to say goodbye to Laura Kennedy. John Norton talks with GLT's retiring diva, and it's GLT's Grow. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A merger between Downers Grove-based Advocate Healthcare and Wisconsin's Aurora Healthcare has created the 10th largest not-for-profit hospital system in the country. The new combined system, called Advocate Aurora Health, has 27 hospitals and about $11 billion in annual revenue. Among the hospitals is Advocate Bromen in Normal. The merged system will keep dual headquarters in Illinois and Wisconsin. Joining us to talk about the merger and about the changing healthcare landscape in general is Colleen Canaday, the CEO of Advocate Bromen Healthcare. Let's start with a question that has no medical implications at all, but one that is a piece of Bloomington Normal culture. The name Bromen and Brokaw before it is part of the history of the area. It's a topic of some discussion around the town, whether that name will disappear and perhaps be relabeled Advocate Aurora Normal. Yes? No? No way?
No, our name is not changing. So that is a key part of our history, and we will continue to be Advocate Bromen Medical Center. And, you know, even with the merger with Advocate Aurora, the recognition of the Advocate name throughout the state of Illinois and the recognition of the Aurora name throughout the state of Wisconsin, we will continue to use those legacy names. So we will remain Advocate Bromen Medical Center very prominently. Many people continue to call us Bromen, which is certainly fine and a key part of our history.
What will people notice?
So, you know, I think a couple of things, maybe just to take a step back. In the changing landscape in healthcare right now, size and scope does make a difference for a number of reasons, of which I want to just highlight. So the merger of Advocate and Aurora coming together, geographically contiguous, we now have the privilege of spanning from central Illinois all the way up through Chicago and through the eastern part of Wisconsin up to Green Bay, Wisconsin. And so having now being the 10th largest national healthcare system, it actually gives us more of a platform to have a national voice on the changing landscape of healthcare and to have input into the changes that are taking place. So there's a number of reasons why the merger makes sense, and we can talk more about those. But when you talk about what changes locally, day-to-day in terms of our staff or the exceptional patient care, that's not going to change. In fact, over time, it will only get better as we continue to learn even best practices that we will learn from the Aurora side of the merger, and that Aurora will learn from the Advocate side of the merger.
In terms of more of a voice, as you said, what does Advocate Aurora want to say nationally?
So, you know, Advocate specifically, which is the side that I've obviously represented, we have really been a national leader on the movement towards population health, which is really focusing on the right care of the patient at the right time, in the right setting, and at the right cost, so at the lowest cost of care that's appropriate. And as part of that, we've been our leadership team of Advocate, including our chief medical officer, has been working with whether it's CMS, the Center for Medicaid and Medicaid Services nationally, even the Obama administration, on developing what those new payment models look like in order to incentivize physicians, hospitals to work together to provide the best care at the lowest cost. And one of the comments that I would just make, Charlie, is Advocate has been so successful on this journey of focusing on better health outcomes for our patients at a lower cost, that we are the second largest accountable care organization nationally currently. And over the course of this last year, for the population that we manage, we saved Medicare over $70 million just for the patients that we as a part of Advocate managed when you compare to other healthcare systems or other providers. So we're really working on, again, creating that new model of care delivery for the best care of the patient.
In terms of being a big system in Illinois or a big system in Wisconsin or a top 10 system nationally, does it really matter in terms of scalability and efficiencies? Does the system size matter as much at that scale as the thing that you said before about best practices and squeezing the costs out?
So I guess a couple of things I would say, you know, with our new merger as Advocate Aurora Health, we've used the phrase nationally recognized, regionally scoped, and locally present. So it really is, from a local perspective, it is about providing the most exceptional care to every one of our patients and all of our community day in and day out. What we hope to be able to gain are some best practices and clinical best practices by working with our colleagues across the entire system. And I think one of the challenges that we have in healthcare is there may be a best practice clinically that's has been implemented in one of our other hospitals, but how do you replicate that? How do you share that best practice or that best clinical practice to be able to take advantage of it locally? And so that's one of the areas that we'll be working on across the entire enterprise. The other thing I would say is really, you know, why does size matter? In this day and time, there is a need to really focus on innovation, innovation models, and innovative models of healthcare delivery. And it takes money to be able to even focus and partner with others on innovative ways of providing healthcare. And we will have the ability as a larger system to do that.
So writ small, you need the ability to lose money on a couple of failed innovative projects in order to discern the ones that really do work.
Oh, that's said very well. Very well.
Okay.
Yes.
Last fall, Advocate laid off 75 of its roughly 35,000 employees as part of $200 million in cuts following a missed revenue target. Looking back, what happened in Bloomington Normal as part of that adjustment?
So we did not have specific layoffs here in Bloomington Normal. And I think the reality of the world we face in healthcare as we continue to look at the best way to provide healthcare is anytime we have a vacancy at any of our hospitals, but specifically at Broman and in our service area, we're always looking at, do we have to fill the position? Can we fill it in a different way? Has our model of care changed? So that's always been a part of our that's always been a part of our culture, really, over the last 8 years since I've been here that we've built. So it doesn't necessitate the need for dramatic changes in staffing.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Colleen Kennedy, the CEO of Advocate Broman Healthcare, which covers both Broman Medical Center in Normal and Eureka over in Woodford County. Reimbursement levels continue to change, and healthcare is becoming more consumer-centric, as you noted. Can you unpack for our audience what that looks like for you?
So as we look at really focusing on consumer-centric care, there's a number of ways that we're looking at that. I think we're continuing to focus, as I mentioned earlier, on providing care for the patient in the right setting, the right cost. So a number of things that we focused on, even very specifically for that, is making sure that patients have open access, right? When you're sick or when your child's sick, you want to be seen then, you want to be seen the same day. So working with our physicians, we're really working to make sure we've got same-day appointments available. So if you need to be seen, you can be seen that same day. Immediate care is another strategy that allows for that to take place. Being able to make online appointments and schedule online for whether it's to be seen at immediate care or to be seen by your physician, that's another important element, being able to receive your lab results back electronically through the patient portal. Those are all ways that we're really focused on making healthcare more consumer-centric.
Recruiting and retaining physicians is more of a challenge nowadays. Physician compensation has been productivity-based for so long. Do another procedure, bill it, do another procedure, bill it, rinse, repeat. It's now less clear because everyone in healthcare is trying to reduce costs on the front end, preventive care. So fewer procedures, less revenue, hopefully lower costs, but less revenue. So how do you keep doctors financially satisfied and the hospital financially viable?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is, and you hit the nail on the head, because healthcare is changing and it's creating new models of reimbursement for our physicians. The first thing that I would say is we're really focused on creating a great environment and a great culture for our physicians to practice. So we like to talk about within our healthcare ministry really being the best place for our patients to heal, our physicians to practice, and our associates to be able to work and use their skills and talents. So culture is really first and foremost, because you want to have a great work environment. But I would also say we're working with our physicians to develop those new compensation models. So it's not something that we're creating and handing to our physicians. We're working side by side with our physicians and creating these new compensation models with them. What does that look like? There's still a portion of physician compensation that is, in many cases, RVU-based. And as we're shifting, more of their compensation is really looking to what we call value. So we're focusing on clinical outcomes, patient satisfaction. All of those elements are really becoming more important and is money that they have, that they earn then for the good work that they're doing, rewarding value that they're providing to the patient. So I would say it's a blended model right now, and I don't think anybody's exactly sure what it's going to look like in the future, but that model we're creating is in partnership with our physician colleagues.
Many hospitals are trying out new service lines to drive some revenue growth. Bromen?
What I would say is our focus as we look at new services is never about how do we drive more revenue. We do a community needs assessment, and then we work with our medical staff and our governing council and really the broader community to say what needs are not being met within our community. And that's really what we look at, what drives new services. So what I would highlight is, just a little over about a year and a half ago, we added neonatology services in this community in partnership with the physicians with Advocate Children's Hospital. So 24/7 within our community, we have specialized physician-only neonatologists that are here to care for our smallest babies that are born. We do about 1,700 deliveries a year at Broman, and we have a number of those babies that now can stay in our immediate care nursery under the care of these neonatologists. So the moms, the babies, and the families can stay together in the community. That was, given the size of our OB and given the size of our community, that was a service we felt that we needed to add from a community need perspective. So I would say that it's not, when we look at community services or new services, we're looking at it from a community need perspective, obviously looking to find the most efficient way to provide it, but it's not about how do you drive a bottom line.
Both Advocate Broman and OSF St. Joseph Medical Centers are level 2 trauma centers. There is not a level 1 in this community.
Correct.
Is that a need?
Is that a need? I guess you could always say there's a need for the highest level of care, the higher level of care. The reality is, given the size of our community and the specialists that would have to be recruited and to be on site to provide that, and given the minimal number of traumas, truly level 1 traumas that we have in this community on an annual basis, I'm not sure that we're the size of a community that would really dictate that.
Champaign-Urbana is not so very much larger than us, and they do have a level 1 trauma center. What's the difference there? The presence of a medical school, so there are available specialists, or what?
Well, certainly the depth that Carl has within the Champaign-Urbana community is... They certainly have a higher level of depth of the subspecialists than we have available within this community. So I think that's a factor that plays into it.
So market share.
They do. I mean, Carl, when you look at the market share and the dominance that they have and what they've invested, certainly that works for their community.
Healthcare organizations are being forced to rely more on revenue from patients due to the rise in popularity of high-deductible health plans. That complicates the collection of bills. You have more payers, and the little guys might not be able to pay the whole thing all at once. How's that going? How are you coping with, I think it's called revenue cycle challenges?
That's a good term. So, you know, the reality is so many of us in the community and nationally have higher deductible health plans. And so actually what we have seen, Charlie, within our own experience is a higher percentage or a higher amount of that that is not collectible or that we actually write off and don't collect. So in essence, it is care that we are providing for free, which is one of the maybe unintended consequences. But the reality, certain people that have a high deductible health plan don't have the means and the ability to be able to pay that difference, and we understand that. The other aspect of it is you talked about consumerism and patients really going out and shopping. We're really focused on positioning our services, and I'll give you an example, to be the most cost-effective because patients are shopping around. So we've got a sleep center that is a joint ventured sleep center, but as an independent IDTF, it is at a lower cost than if it were hospital-based. So it's off-site, but what we charge as an IDTF is less than if it were a hospital-based service. So that's part of the shift that we're seeing in the delivery of healthcare.
With that shift, with preventive rather than acute care as a touchstone, with procedures being squeezed out of the healthcare system, hospital stays are also declining and rehab facilities are becoming more dominant. So acute care beds are awfully expensive to maintain if they're empty, and you kind of want more of them empty.
Correct.
Will Bloomington Normal ever reach a point where we have one hospital instead of two?
I don't have a crystal ball for what the future holds, so I certainly wouldn't make a prediction on that. What I would comment on, though, is the patients, because fewer patients are being admitted and more are being managed in the outpatient setting, the patients that we are seeing that are being admitted to the hospital are actually much sicker and have many more comorbidities. So the intensity of care and services that they see is actually more. So quite frankly, we've actually seen a bit of an increase in our length of stay when you look at it in aggregate, because those lower level length of stays are no longer coming to the hospital. And what we have remaining are really those patients that are very sick and are requiring more intensive services to be in an inpatient setting. And then the other aspect that I would say is we've got on-site at Broman, as an example, an acute rehabilitation department where we treat patients after they've had a stroke or total joints and require more intensive therapy. And we're investing money. When you talk about growth of services, we are doing about $500,000 renovation, a good bit of which is now coming from philanthropy and community support to better serve patients in that acute rehabilitation setting, because we're seeing a shift and a growth in that area. So we're continuing to even modify our inpatient facility to focus on the changing needs of the community that we serve.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Colleen Canaday is the CEO of Advocate ProMen Healthcare. At the risk of getting too inside baseball here, linking worker engagement with patient experience is also a cost driver or a cost saver. How does this affect the bottom line? It certainly affects quality of care, but the cost.
So we focus very heavily on our associate engagement and measure every year the engagement of our associates. So again, it goes back to what I said earlier about culture. Mm-hmm. And we have a very low turnover rate within our organization. And, you know, a number of long-term associates or employees. In fact, tonight's our service awards, and we're recognizing five individuals for 45 years of service to Broman. With our associate engagement and the focus on creating a great environment for our associates, we focus also on teamwork, making sure our associates have the tools that they need, lines of communication are open, partnership. And at the end of the day, when we reduce turnover and have engaged, happy associates, that saves money right there.
Yeah. How do you also make them aware of the big picture analytics and metrics so they can relate those pressures to the big scale things to the scale on which they operate? You know, they see little things done over and over again, and that certainly affects the bottom line. But how can you get them to say, aha, this is something I should push upward?
Communication is key. I always say you can never communicate enough. So we work on many ways to be able to communicate and have two-way communication with all of our associates. So part of that is we do forums where associates come together and we actually share information. We do system-wide forums where we link in and then it's played on your computer so you can listen so that everybody's hearing the same message from our CEOs of our healthcare system. We round on associates, so on all shifts, so we'll come in on the night shift and go around and talk with associates, answer questions, and leave handouts and talk about the mission, our strategies, what we're focused on, what questions they might have. They hear about that in their own department meetings. So there's many different ways we use to communicate. Electronic newsletter that we have every week that includes a special Did You Know section for me where I have the ability to share. And then we also have on our intranet site, what's called Colleen's Corner, where everyone has the ability to post questions that I answer directly that everybody can see as well.
Crystal balls all over the nation have been remarkably fuzzy and cloudy over these last few years, both at the state and the federal level. Are things clarifying? We've had one budget. We're hoping for two in a row from the state. We hope. Are things clarifying there?
I don't know that I would say things are clarifying. What I would say, though, is I'm an eternal optimist, and I do believe that we've got great things going on within our own community here with Be an Advantage and the partnership with the Economic Development Council and the Chamber, the good work that's going on. And from a state perspective, having a budget is better than not having a budget. And at the end of the day, our responsibility is to make sure that we're living out our mission and our values, which is providing the most exceptional care for our patients and our community. So regardless, we're actively working with our legislators locally and in Springfield and at the federal level. But within that, we also have to focus on the components that we can control. And at the end of the day, that continues to be focusing on the needs of our community and the ways that we can continue to expand our services. So we're focused on that, along with the national and the federal. We're very focused on what we can do locally.
Do you think that Medicaid reimbursement rates will continue to fall?
I am not optimistic that Medicaid rates are going to go up. And within our planning and within our assumptions that we make, we do not plan for increases in Medicaid. And we have to continue to find a way to work within those constraints and to make sure that our community is cared for.
Has unreimbursed care risen sharply over the last 5 years?
So unreimbursed care continues to go up for many reasons. You've got 10,000 people a day that are moving onto the rolls of Medicare that maybe yesterday were reimbursed by Blue Cross or Health Alliance through their employer and moving to Medicare. I commented, we talked about the fact that more people have high deductible health plans that we do not get reimbursed for, oftentimes a good portion of that. And then you've got the growing gap. Actually, we had expanded in the state of Illinois Medicaid providers for patients. And within that now, we have continued to see a growing number over the last year of uninsured. So that number is actually rising.
And federal health policy is much different under the Trump administration than it was under the Obama administration. Are you getting a clear direction there?
I don't know that I would say that it's substantially different today. I think our focus continues to be on the movement towards population health, the movement towards value and best health outcomes at the lowest cost, regardless. And so there are still so many of the components of what people would call as Obamacare that are in play and in place. And actually, a lot of that movement, even before the legislation with Obamacare, so to speak, was written, you had your healthcare systems, your physicians, your providers, and your insurance companies coming together already to partner on new ways to provide care and provide financial incentives back to physicians to focus on wellness, not just treating patients when they're sick.
So you're saying that conversation has to happen regardless of federal policy?
Yes, well said.
Colleen Canaday is the CEO of Advocate ProMed Healthcare. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Charlie. Thanks for having me.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
All of us at GLT have two important words we want you to hear. Thank you. Nearly 500 people contributed during the latest fund drive.
I'm GLT financial supporter Alexis Wolstein.
I'm Dan Lannon.
I'm Carolyn Pitts.
We're grateful so many of you value NPR and GLT and everything we do, but guess what?
The fund drive may be over, but it's not too late for you to contribute.
We fell a little short, so we hope you'll take the time to contribute.
Pledge at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Mike Thornton Agency, presenting the musical and political comedy satire of the Capitol Steps at the BCPA Sunday, May 13th at 3 p.m. Mentioning GLT when you call the box office for tickets will give you a special rate. Tickets at 309-434-2777. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, spring has sprung, the grass has riz, time for Grow to tell you what is. Laura Kennedy has worn many different hats during her 30-year tenure at GLT, some of them flapper hats. She began as a classical music host, morphed into a jazz diva, and now produces a dizzying array of stories and programs for GLT and Sound Ideas. Kennedy retires from WGLT and Illinois State University May 31st. Today, we start our goodbyes. Laura is in studio with Morning Edition host John Norton.
Laura Kennedy, how are you? How are you, Laura Kennedy?
I'm splendid. How are you?
Didn't we take you right off the Shakespeare stage to get you here at GLT 30 years ago?
Yeah, I put my codpiece in mothballs.
Let's go back to the beginning.
Oh, my gosh. Back when it was analog.
30 years ago, you started at GLT. Were you a student when you first started?
I did start here as a student. I was a mass comm major here at Illinois State University with an emphasis in radio broadcasting. And I was working at ZND. I needed an internship, so I came over here, and at the time, Terry Bush was the development director, and I went to him and I said, hey, look, I've got some writing skills, and, you know, and I pushed myself. That was probably the first time I've ever had to do that in my life where I had to really sell myself, and he said, okay, and he gave me an internship in my senior year, and then after I graduated, a few months later, they offered me a job. I came back and I said, hey, could you use me? And they said, you bet. And they, the fools, they hired me.
Well, I want to read a quote from you. It's the bio on your website. I'm sure this is your line.
It has to be.
Kennedy appalled her family by going into show business. Is there truth to that? Or is that just a funny line?
Well, I don't know if I appalled them so much. It's kind of unusual. I do have a cousin who is an opera singer, so it's not completely not done in my family, but it was a little bit out of the ordinary with all the people who became, you know, college deans and went into the military and, you know, became hedge fund managers and things like that. And there's little me, or dinky little me, going off to do public radio.
You've been here 30 years. You haven't left.
I know.
You're so talented in so many areas. Why did you stay at GLT for 30 years?
My family is here. Mm-hmm. And my GLT family is here. I love working with the people here. It's been so much fun. There's such a great array of different people that I've worked with over the years. And the fact is, because of the format changes, I've actually worked at like three different radio stations, but I have not had to change my zip code, you know, because I got here and it was classical. I worked in development, at first, and then I started working as a classical host. Then we changed the format, and I became a jazz host, and then I also became an arts reporter. Then they changed the format to News Talk, and I became a news host as well as a content producer for, you know, stuff for Sound Ideas and podcasts and things like that. So I basically have changed jobs three times, but I haven't had to, you know, get my fanny out of town at all.
I want to get to that in just a minute, but Ooh. First I want to embarrass you.
Oh, great.
There are two quick stories. One, in Cleveland, you, I, and Willis Kern, our former news director, were in Cleveland about 3-4 years ago for NPR training.
That was great.
And there's a room about 50 people. Laura's keeping quiet, all these questions, and then finally she asked a question real humbly, and it took about 10 seconds to ask the question, and this hardcore moderator, someone who's been with NPR for 30 years herself probably, looked at you and went, "Can you keep talking?"
And my voice is a freak of nature.
Well,
I will
and then on
that.
Facebook, we just had a William Wilson said, "I remember when she called me once about a question for the Dean of Green. She had such a perfect voice, I thought she was a recording." Isn't that nice? Where does that voice come from?
Freak of nature. It's it's deeper than most. I don't know. Maybe I have long vocal cords or something. But when I loved using it when I was a kid because it always made me seem older. So I could, you know, I could order a drink when I was 15 years old, get into R-rated movies and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's just how my voice is. It's always been this way. I've never had any vocal training at all, believe it or not.
I don't believe that.
Nope, have never had any vocal training.
Well, you also
I did have a lisp when I was young.
How did you get rid of that?
I had speech therapy.
Okay.
So I had to learn, you know, and sometimes when I'm lazy, it pops out again. But I had to learn like where to put my tongue in my mouth, but then nothing to do with my voice, just where to put the teeth and where to put the tongue. So I got rid of my lisp.
Well,
pretty
this
much.
Weird thing that pops out every once in a while, this English accent that pops out of you too, right?
Every now and again, yes, I will affect an English accent, just for the fun of it.
Well, and your wit. You've got a wicked and quick wit.
Well,
is that
you.
Part of the Kennedy family? Or
it
are
is.
You, yeah?
It is.
Or do you have to be on your toes in the Kennedy family?
You have to be on your toes in the family. And my father taught here at the university. He was rather renowned for his sense of humor. Some people appreciate it. Not everybody appreciated it, just like with me. I can get a little inappropriate sometimes, but I like, that's just my nature, you know, and the Kennedys are always joking around.
Well, briefly, you mentioned some memories, a few people and memories of GLT. Is there one or two that sticks with you over the years?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, I love working with all kinds of people. There was Eric Radicke, who was a classical host along with me, and I called him, my big bow hunk, because, you know, he was like 9'7". And he was an amazing guy. He was a lot of fun. And a real fan of the Ramones and punk. And then he would just go on the air and talk about Mendelssohn and Schubert. And I just love that sort of interesting juxtaposition that he had. And working with Mark Boone. Mark Boone was always a lot of fun. And Lisa Labas, who now works up at WBEZ. She's their morning edition host.
Absolutely,
so she's
yeah.
your counterpart up there in Chicago. And Lisa and I always had a lot of laughs together. And even though I wasn't in the news department at that point, I used to hang out in the newsroom because we were all the same age in there. We were all in our 20s. And just sitting around and having some great laughs and going over to Garcia's for lunch. It was great.
Well, you do a lot of other things besides when you were hosting classical music, and then you morphed into the jazz diva for GLT at that time. Was it a difficult transition?
No, not at all. I was raised on this music.
Mm-hmm.
So in my family, we would easily go from listening to Beethoven to listening to Billy Taylor or Ramsey Lewis or Benny Goodman, and then we'd go back and listen to some Mozart. So this was just a natural part of my upbringing.
The jazz age is, I guess, the jazz age of the 1920s. Is right up your alley. We talk about this all the time. You have a fascination with the 1920s. You're our flapper girl here at GLT, right?
I did have a bob for a while, didn't I?
Were you born 60 years too late?
I don't know. I mean,
how do you look at that? I mean, where did that come from?
I love history. We love history in my family.
But the 1920s really sticks out for you.
It sticks out. I love silent movies,
uh-huh.
and I love that era of music as well. It's an exciting era. It was an era of rapid and fascinating change and great advances in all kinds of things, from technology to the arts. So, and I think like a lot of people, I find the 1920s very fascinating.
Are movies different today than they were back then?
Yeah,
as far as their
sound
characters?
Now.
Besides that? You're a Turner Classic Movie fan as well.
Oh, gracious, so. Yeah. You have to get me away from that with a crowbar, I'm telling you. I'm late some mornings because I'm like, wait, I have to finish watching Betty Davis. I love this scene. Yeah, things, movies have changed a lot since the 1920s, but the essential remains that we want to be entertained. We want to see stories that we can relate to. We want to see things that will inspire us as well.
Well, from Jazz Diva, you've hosted, you morphed into a content
Yes, more of a content producer
because you were doing some of that before, but now you're our most prolific producer of content on GLT. This was about 3-4 years ago. How did you embrace that change? That was the radical. Classical to jazz is fairly easy. This was pretty
to become a reporter. Yeah. I actually just thought that if I made myself. If I found myself able to do all kinds of different things and I could say, look, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this, I would make myself very useful and they would want to keep me around when, you know, because I've seen a lot of trouble with the budget, the state budget and things being cut and I wanted to keep my job. So I thought the best way to do that was to be as versatile as possible and to be open to change and to say, sure, I'll pivot, I'll do this. And I love the arts. I was raised on the arts. That was a big part of my life. So I started just doing interviews when they asked me to do it, and it just kept blossoming from there.
Was it scary at first?
No, not terribly. I mean, I did sort of think, well, what am I going to ask the conductor of the Illinois Symphony Orchestra? And I just thought, you know, I'll just ask questions I would ask at a cocktail party. I just want to ask questions that everybody else is thinking about, and I want to make the interview sound like a conversation. I want the listener to get the feeling that they're eavesdropping on a conversation. I want that level of intimacy and information and satisfaction.
Well, you often bring out, by the way, this is GLT Sound Ideas.
Yes, it is.
I forgot to say that a few minutes ago. I'm John Norton with Laura Kennedy.
Yes, indeed.
Who is retiring May 31st.
May 31st.
Oh, so many people sad that they're not going to be able to hear you on GLT, but we're happy for you because you're entering a new part of your life that I'm sure is very exciting. The arts.
Yes.
You often bring out in people how the arts reflect society, how morality is embedded in the arts itself. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about why that's important for you to bring that out as well?
Well, because I think we sometimes overlook, you know, the arts because we see so much funding cut from schools and people thinking the arts are just fluff or frivolous or what have you.
Yeah.
But they're not. They help us explore who we are and they help us grow as people. You can learn a lot when you study politics or history or what have you, but art goes deeper, and art can break down walls rather than build them.
Another talent you have around here is you find and locate talented people within the university, within the community.
I have radar.
And you can create characters from these people. They get names like Culture Maven,
right? Oh, the Culture Maven, yes.
And the Psych Geeks, right?
Yes. I'm really lucky, you know. I just meet people. And I think, you know what, and I'll do one interview and I'll think, that was really interesting. You know, this person is an expert on this certain topic or what have you. You know, I can bring them back and we could do something on a regular basis. That really makes me happy to find people that I think are really cool and then thrust them into the spotlight, not quite against their will. But I love being able to do that, to put the spotlight on other people who have something really wonderful to offer in our community. And so people in the community know just how much great talent and smart people we have here in our community.
There are so many questions. We could go on for half an hour, another half an hour easily. I want to get to a couple of people around here who wanted to ask a question. Pat Peterson, our director of individual giving. She wanted to ask you, if GLT were a sitcom, who would you be?
If GLT, I would be, oh my goodness. I don't know. I would be maybe Blair from The Facts of Life or Elaine from Seinfeld.
That's a good answer.
Elaine from Seinfeld, yeah.
Okay, all right. And Bobby Castillo, our corporate support person, and Nicole Welch, our business manager.
Oh, boy.
Both wanted to know how you continually tap into the fountain of youth.
Sunscreen. And just staying open. You got to stay open. Listen, listening is so important. We're in a business where we talk all the time, but the most important part of our jobs is listening. And that's crucial as broadcasters, as reporters, and as people, listening.
You're retiring relatively young.
Yeah, I'm only 32.
Well, I was going to say 40, so I apologize. What's on your agenda?
Well, I thought I'd take a nap and then order a pizza. Do you think I should have pepperoni on that?
Well, if you're asking me, yeah, but you're not going to go any further than that?
Well, you know,
because people want to know.
Well, you know, I used to do voiceovers back in the day, so I might be looking back into that, too.
Hollywood?
No, I'm not going to Hollywood. I'm going to let technology do that for me.
Well, best of luck to you, Laura.
Thank
it's been
you.
Great working for you. I've
and
had an
too.
Opportunity for 15 years to work with you. Others have had longer, but...
It's been a pleasure, because you're a blast.
You're going to be missed.
Well, thank you. I'll miss it, too, but we're all going to have fun.
Thank
new
you,
possibilities, new horizons.
I'm John Norton.
GLT's Laura Kennedy and John Norton. Kennedy retires from WGLT and Illinois State University May 31st. Stop by and say hi and farewell to Laura May 24th at the University Galleries from 5 to 7 p.m. There will be laughter, tears, good memories, and we'll get Laura to say crikey one more time. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the University of Illinois system. Three universities, Urbana-Champaign, Chicago, and Springfield. One system, 83,000 students, 22,000 degrees awarded each year. That's the U of I system, altogether extraordinary. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Listening to 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can stop waiting. It looks like spring is here to stay until summer, that is, and that means you've got work to do. Patrick Murphy has a few ideas to get you started on this edition of GLT's Grow.
Spring may have been a little late this year, but now's your chance to get some spring tasks done in the landscape. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field, from the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. It's Patrick Murphy. Hello, Murph.
Hi, Laura.
Today on GLT's Grow, a spring to-do list. And I guess there's probably a lot to get done. It's been a long winter.
It has been. And here in central Illinois, it's sunny finally, and it's like we're right into the weather of deep summer with temps in the 70s and 80s. And so most people are on their first, second, and sometimes third mow. Most people mow the yard 26 to 34 times a year.
Mm.
And so here we are. It's underway. So in our spring preparations or our growing season preparations, we want to have planned for or will be doing very soon your weed and feed application for your turf.
Okay, so that's for the lawn.
That's for the lawn. And then we want to get our compost station set up. If you don't have one, now is the time, because with the other items on this list, you're going to need a place to put some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm against putting it in the garbage and burning it all the time. Sometimes is okay, so... Compost.
Where is a good place for that, do you think?
In the blazing sun.
Okay.
And hopefully in a spot where you can kind of hide it from your views outward.
Mm-hmm.
You definitely would not want it in the front of your house. That's the public view.
Right.
So if you got a hot, sunny corner back there behind the garden shed or behind the Airstream camper parked in the yard, that's the spot for it. The hot sun helps that compost break down, and... there may be an odor, typically not, but keep that in mind. Keep turning it. If you're throwing lots of household waste in there, it's nice to have it away from the house. It's also now the time, I believe, there's no threat of snow or ice control.
Mm-hmm.
So let's think about repairing any damage done by the snow plows or done by the de-icing agents.
Oh, how can we do that?
Well, a lot of times it's something as simple as taking a rake and just kind of flattening out the little scuff mark that was made by the plow, or it maybe came off of the edge of the curb or at the spot where the driveway connects with the sidewalk. That's an area that oftentimes gets beat up by the snow plow. But if you're a business owner and the complex is managed, there might be a lot of de-icing agents that were used on the primary walkways, and some of those can build up in the soil and actually damage the turf there. That's a cut and replace type of repair where you got to cut away the bad stuff because the grass seed and sod's not going to go there.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of gave you the easiest and the hardest stuff. You know, you might have a little bush that was pushed out of the ground. You might be able to just replant it. But that's what you can assess and plan for. And then I have the five typicals that we were always going to do in the spring.
Okay. Let's hear number one.
Mulch.
Okay.
There is such thing as too much mulch, but now's the time to do it.
But don't do too much.
Right. You know, you want to test, run, and program your irrigation systems if you have one. It's time to get that up and running. Get the dewinterization reversed. Get the lines filled up with water. Let it run.
Mm-hmm.
Especially here in central Illinois. It's dry right now, man. The ground's cracking all over the place. So let it run for a while. And then set your programs for your morning waterings for now. Remove the old tree stakes. So if you planted a bunch of trees in the fall, you could probably safely remove the tree stakes now.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show. For those who like to get their hands dirty, this week we're looking at a spring to-do list. So get those tree stakes up and out of the ground.
And may I say, the tree stakes, Laura, are to prevent the roots from moving around when the tree is being blown by the wind above ground.
Okay.
So if the tree's been in the ground and it's starting to take root below ground, that can happen quickly. But if it's in a spot where there's a wind exposure, you might want to leave them on a little longer. You want to think about your bedding plant preparation. Where are you going to plant your flowers?
Oh, yeah.
Right? So that's easiest done with the preparation fight conducted first. You know, so cultivate the soil, break that soil up, maybe add some organic matter like peat moss or mushroom compost, and prepare and build up your planting areas where you're going to put bedding plants like annual flowers.
And you've said this before, to go ahead and put the mulch down and then do your planting.
I'm a big fan of that because when the planting is done at that point, you are also done. And it's really difficult, in my opinion, to cram the mulch in around a bunch of tender, brand new plants that are maybe only inches apart. So you get the soil nice and fluffy, cover it with mulch, and if a little bit of the mulch gets mixed in with the soil, jackpot.
Yeah.
That's compost. That's organic matter. So then the fifth thing we want to do is build our natural defenses. Physical security of our landscape is the BT and Milky Spore, and we're going to bang that drum really hard.
I love BT products. They really work.
Right here in central Illinois, the Japanese beetles have been a problem.
Yes.
And it takes the Milky Spore and the BT 2 to 3 years to build up in the soil. So if you're just getting started, now's the time to get that going. Do that in the spring. You might get a little residual benefit from the first and second year. But the sooner you start, the sooner you're done.
I'm kind of curious. If you have had, say, bagworms on your evergreens in previous years, would it ever make sense in the spring to pre-spray your trees with a BT product to sort of discourage them from even establishing?
I think that the BT products that are applied to the soil are best because they're ingested by all the plants in the landscape. And when it comes to the bagworms, yes, there are lots of effective sprays, but a bagworm is easy to spot.
Yeah.
They're easy to find. And I would venture to guess that the preparation time for setting up your spray and having it done at the right time, which is when the air is stable, that's early in the morning when you're getting ready for work or having breakfast on the weekend. I just think it's easier to pick the doggone things off.
And stomp on them.
Pick them off and throw them in a paper bag and then throw them in your compost bin. But stepping on them is a good idea because then they can't just crawl out of the bag and right back up into the tree and back to work.
Yes, that would discourage them if you stepped on them.
So it's not that I don't like the spraying. It's the last result in a good IPM program, and we preach that here at Grow.
Yes, and we do that indeed, and we start in the spring like right now.
That's right.
So what else?
Well, I also think it's a good time to get ready for Mother's Day, right? So if you're going to have mom and the family over, get ready for that. So get your lawn chairs and stuff all wiped off and dusted off. You don't want to see mom's bottom dirty because you didn't get the chairs cleaned off.
Oh,
I mean,
no.
How humiliating for your mother.
Absolutely. She deserves better than a dirty bottom.
Right. And also, too, you're going to have to plan for all these guests. Where are they going to park? So you might want to do your neighbors a courtesy and let them know, hey, we're having the whole fam-damily over on Sunday for Mother's Day. Can we have the school bus parked in the driveway that day?
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever. I think that's a little bit outside the parameters of our cleanup stuff. But Mother's Day is part of spring.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, so.
Because for me, Mother's Day is the day that says, okay, now you could start putting things in the ground. Because for me, it's a firm rule, never plant before Mother's Day.
And that's probably why so many nurseries have their record sales days on either side of Mother's Day.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, and the Kiwanis have their flower sale and everything as well.
There's a lot of plant sales. ISU's Fell Arboretum plant sale is Saturday, May 5th from 8 to 11. Mm-hmm. Luthia Botanic Garden in Peoria is having one that starts Friday and runs through Sunday. Extension plant sales, they're happening all over Illinois and the Midwest and probably the rest of America this weekend.
And you could get great plants that were locally started and cultivated.
It's great to support local agriculture. It's also great to get stuff that not everyone else is selling.
That's right. Yeah, get something unique for your garden. That will be one thing definite to put on your spring to-do list. Now, next week on GLT's Grow, seed banks and why they're important. We have one here at Illinois State University. We're going to be talking about that and why seed banks are vital. If you've got a gardening question that you would like to send in to MRF, we would love to hear from you. Go to our website, wglt.org/grow, fill in the form, and send that right along to us. Feel free to include a photo with your garden issue. Submit the questions at wglt.org/grow.
One, two. Thanks
for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, a service of Illinois State University's School of Communication. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from John Norton and Laura Kennedy. Find the full show podcast at WGLT.org or Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.